8. Departure of the Hero. The last act in the biography of the hero is that of the death or departure. Here the whole sense of the life is epitomized. Needless to say, the hero would be no hero if death held for him any terror. The first condition is reconciliation with the grave.
While sitting under the oak of Mamre, Abraham perceived a flashing of light and a smell of sweet odor, and turning around, he saw death coming toward him in great glory and beauty. And death said unto Abraham, "Think not, Abraham, that this beauty is mine, or that I come thus to every man. Nay, but if anyone is righteous like thee, I thus take a crown and come to him. But if he is a sinner, I come in great corruption, and out of their sins I make a crown for my head, and I shake them with great fear, so that they are dismayed." Abraham said to him, "And art thou indeed he that is called Death?" He answered and said, "I am the bitter name." But Abraham answered, "I will not go with thee." And Abraham said to Death, "Show us thy corruption." And Death revealed his corruption, showing two heads. The one had the face of a serpent, the other head was like a sword. All the servants of Abraham, looking at the fierce mien of Death, died. But Abraham prayed to the Lord, and he raised them up. As the looks of Death were not able to cause Abraham's soul to depart from him, God removed the soul of Abraham as in a dream, and the archangel Michael took it up into heaven. After great praise and glory had been given to the Lord by the angels who brought Abraham's soul, and after Abraham bowed down to worship, then came the voice of God, saying thus, "Take my friend Abraham into paradise. Where are the tabernacles of my righteous ones, and the abodes of my saints Isaac and Jacob in his bosom, where there is no trouble, nor grief, nor sighing, but peace and rejoicing and life unending?"
Compare the following dream.
"I was on a bridge where I met a blind fiddler. Everyone was tossing coins into his hat. I came closer and perceived that the musician was not blind. He had a squint and was looking at me with a crooked glance from the side. Suddenly there was a little old woman sitting at the side of a road. It was dark and I was afraid. 'Where does this road lead?' I thought. A young peasant came along the road and took me by the hand. 'Do you want to come home?' he said, 'and drink coffee?' 'Let me go! You are holding too tight,' I cried, and awoke."
The hero, who in his life represented the dual perspective, after his death is still a synthesizing image. Like Charlemagne, he sleeps only and will arise in the hour of destiny, or he is among us under another form. The Aztecs tell of the feathered serpent Quetzalcoatl, monarch of the ancient city of Tolan in the golden age of its prosperity. He was the teacher of the arts, originator of the calendar, and the giver of maize. He and his people were overcome at the closing of their time by the stronger magic of an invading race, the Aztecs. Tezcatlipoca, the warrior hero of the younger people and their era, broke the city of Tolan, and the feathered serpent, king of the Golden Age, burned his dwellings behind him, buried his treasures in the mountains, transformed his chocolate trees into mesquite, commanded the multicolored birds, his servants, to fly before him, and departed in great sorrow. And he came to a city called Quatitlan, where there was a tree, very tall and large. And he went over to the tree, sat down beneath it, and gazed into a mirror that was brought to him. "I am old," he said, and the place was named the Old Quatitlan. Resting again at another place along the way, and looking back in the direction of his Tolan, he wept and his tears went through a rock. He left in that place the mark of his sitting and the impress of his palms. He was met and challenged further along by a group of necromancers, who prohibited him from proceeding until he had left with them the knowledge of working silver, wood, and feathers, and the art of painting. As he crossed the mountains, all of his attendants, who were dwarfs and humpbacks, died of cold. At another place, he encountered his antagonist, Tezcatlipoca, who defeated him at a game of ball. At still another, he aimed with an arrow at a large pochital tree. The arrow, too, was an entire pochital tree, so that when he shot it through the first, they formed a cross. And so he passed along, leaving many signs and place names behind him, until, coming at last to the sea, he departed on a raft of serpents. It is not known how he arrived at his destination, Tlapayan, his original home. Or, according to another tradition, at the shore he immolated himself upon a funeral pyre, and birds with multicolored feathers arose from his ashes. His soul became the morning star. The life-eager hero can resist death and postpone his fate for a certain time. It is written that Cuchulainn, in his sleep, heard a cry so terrible and fearful that he fell out of his bed upon the ground like a sack in the east wing of the house. He rushed forth without weapons, followed by Aymer, his wife, who carried his arms and garments. And he discovered a chariot harnessed with a chestnut horse that had but one leg, the pole passing through its body and out at the forehead. Within sat a woman, her eyebrows red, and a crimson mantle round her. A very big man walked along beside, also in a coat of crimson, carrying a forked staff of hazelwood and driving a cow. Cuchulainn claimed the cow as his own. The woman challenged him, and Cuchulainn then demanded to know why she was speaking instead of the big man. She answered that the man was Wargaith Shkyo, Lukir Shkyo. "Well, to be sure," said Cuchulainn, "the length of the name is astonishing." "The woman to whom you speak," said the big man, "is called Thabor Begbe Yoel, Kumjer Folt Shkubgairit Shkyo Uwa." "You are making a fool of me," said Cuchulainn, and he made a leap into the chariot, put his 2 feet on her 2 shoulders and his spear on the parting of her hair. "Do not play your sharp weapons on me," she said. "Then tell me your true name," said Cuchulainn. "Go further off from me then," said she. "I am a female satirist, and I carry off this cow as a reward for a poem." "Let us hear your poem," said Cuchulainn. "Only move further off," said the woman. "Your shaking over my head will not influence me." Cuchulainn moved off until he was between the 2 wheels of the chariot. The woman sang at him a song of challenge and insult. He prepared to spring again, but in an instant, horse, woman, chariot, man, and cow had disappeared, and on the branch of a tree was a black bird. "A dangerous enchanted woman you are," said Cuchulainn to the black bird, for he now realized that she was the battle goddess Bibe, or Morrigan. "If I had only known that it was you, we should not have parted thus." "What you have done," replied the bird, "will bring you ill luck." "You cannot harm me," said Cuchulainn. "Certainly I can," said the woman. "I am guarding your deathbed, and I shall be guarding it henceforth." Then the enchantress told him that she was taking the cow from the fairy hill of Cruachan to be bred by the bull of the big man, who was Kolnya, and when her calf was 1 year old, Cuchulainn would die. She herself would come against him when he would be engaged at a certain ford with a man as strong, as victorious, as dexterous, as terrible, as untiring, as noble, as brave, as great as himself. I will become an eel, she said, and I will throw a noose round thy feet in the ford. Cahoolin exchanged threats with her, and she disappeared into the ground. But the following year, at the foretold foray at the ford, he overcame her, and actually lived to die another day. A curious, perhaps playful echo of the symbolism of salvation in a yonder world dimly sounds in the final passage of the Pueblo folktale of Water Jar Boy.
A lot of people were living down inside the spring, women and girls. They all ran to the boy and put their arms around him because they were glad their child had come to their house. Thus, the boy found his father and his aunts, too. Well, the boy stayed there one night, and next day he went back home and told his mother he had found his father. Then his mother got sick and died. Then the boy said to himself, "No use for me to live with these people." So he left them and went to the spring. And there was his mother. That was the way he and his mother went to live with his father. His father was Ivayopee, Water Snake Red. He said he could not live with them over at Sikyatki. That was the reason he made the boy's mother sick, so she died, and came over here to live with me, said his father. Now we will live here together, said Avayo to his son. That's the way that boy and his mother went to the spring to live there.
This story, like that of the clam wife, repeats point for point the mythical narrative. The two stories are charming in their apparent innocence of their power. At the opposite extreme is the account of the death of the Buddha, humorous like all great myth, but conscious to the last degree.
The Blessed One, accompanied by a large congregation of priests, drew near to the further bank of the Hiranavati River and to the city of Kusinara and the sal tree grove Upavatana of the Malas, and having drawn near, he addressed the Venerable Ananda. "Be so good, Ananda, as to spread me a couch with its head to the north, between twin sal trees. I am weary, Ananda, and wish to lie down." "Yes, Reverend Sir," said the Venerable Ananda to the Blessed One in assent, and spread the couch with its head to the north between twin sal trees. Then the Blessed One lay down on his right side, after the manner of a lion, and placing foot on foot, remained mindful and conscious. Now at that time, the twin sal trees had completely burst forth into bloom, though it was not the flowering season, and the blossoms scattered themselves over the body of the Tathagata, and strewed and sprinkled themselves in worship of the Tathagata. Also heavenly sandalwood powder fell from the sky, and this scattered itself over the body of the Tathagata, and strewed and sprinkled itself in worship of the Tathagata. And music sounded in the sky in worship of the Tathagata, and heavenly choruses were heard to sing in worship of the Tathagata.
During the conversations which then took place, as the Tathagata lay like a lion on his side, a large priest, the Venerable Upavana, stood in front, fanning him. The Blessed One briefly ordered him to step aside, whereupon the body attendant of the Blessed One, Ananda, complained to the Blessed One. "Reverend Sir," he said, "what, pray, was the reason, and what was the cause that the Blessed One was harsh to the Venerable Upavana, saying, 'Step aside, O priest, stand not in front of me'?" The Blessed One replied,
"Ananda, almost all the deities throughout 10 worlds have come together to behold the Tathagata. For an extent, Ananda, of 12 leagues about the city Kusinara and the sal tree grove Upavatana of the Malas, there is not a spot of ground large enough to stick the point of a hair into that is not pervaded by powerful deities. And these deities, Ananda, are angered, saying, From afar have we come to behold the Tathagata, for but seldom and on rare occasions does a Tathagata, a saint and supreme Buddha, arise in the world. And now, tonight, in the last watch, will the Tathagata pass into Nirvana. But this powerful priest stands in front of the Blessed One, concealing him, and we have no chance to see the Tathagata, although his last moments are near. Thus, Ananda, are these deities angered? What are the deities doing, Reverend Sir, whom the Blessed One perceives? Some of the deities, Ananda, are in the air with their minds engrossed by earthly things, and they let fly their hair and cry aloud, and stretch out their arms and cry aloud, and fall headlong to the ground and roll to and fro, saying, "All too soon will the Blessed One pass into Nirvana. All too soon will the light of the world vanish from sight." Some of the deities, Ananda, are on the earth with their minds engrossed by earthly things, and they let fly their hair and cry aloud, and stretch out their arms and cry aloud, and fall headlong to the ground and roll to and fro, saying, "All too soon will the Blessed One pass into Nirvana. All too soon will the Happy One pass into Nirvana. All too soon will the light of the world vanish from sight." But those deities which are free from passion, mindful and conscious, bear it patiently, saying, "Transitory are all things. How is it possible that whatever has been born, has come into being, and is organized and perishable, should not perish? That condition is not possible."
The last conversations continued for some time, and during the course of them, the Blessed One gave consolation to his priests. Then he addressed them. "And now, O priests, I take my leave of you. All the constituents of being are transitory. Work out your salvation with diligence." And this was the last word of the Tathagata.
Thereupon the Blessed One entered the first trance, and rising from the first trance, he entered the second trance, and rising from the second trance, he entered the third trance, and rising from the third trance, he entered the fourth trance, and rising from the fourth trance, he entered the realm of the infinity of space, and rising from the realm of the infinity of space, he entered the realm of the infinity of consciousness. And rising from the realm of the infinity of consciousness, he entered the realm of nothingness. And rising from the realm of nothingness, he entered the realm of neither perception nor yet non-perception. And rising from the realm of neither perception nor yet non-perception, he arrived at the cessation of perception and sensation. Thereupon the Venerable Ananda spoke to the Venerable Anuruddha as follows. "Reverend Anuruddha, the Blessed One has passed into Nirvana." "Nay, Brother Ananda, the Blessed One has not yet passed into Nirvana. He has arrived at the cessation of perception and sensation." Thereupon the Blessed One, rising from the cessation of his perception and sensation, entered the realm of neither perception nor yet non-perception. And rising from the realm of neither perception nor yet non-perception, he entered the realm of nothingness. And rising from the realm of nothingness, he entered the realm of infinity of consciousness. And rising from the realm of infinity of consciousness, he entered the realm of the infinity of space. And rising from the realm of the infinity of space, he entered the fourth trance. And rising from the fourth trance, he entered the third trance. And rising from the third trance, he entered the second trance. And rising from the second trance, he entered the first trance. And rising from the first trance, he entered the second trance. And rising from the second trance, he entered the third trance. And rising from the third trance, he entered the fourth trance. And rising from the fourth trance, immediately, the Blessed One passed into Nirvana.